With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. Today I want to talk about the question of British national identity and its relationship to warfare in the 20th century. And I think it's really pertinent to talk about this now because, as Brexit is showing us, we're in another period of great uncertainty about British national identity. About English, Scottish, Irish and Welsh national identities, and about what Britain is and its role in the world and what the country's all about, and by extension, the people that live in it. And no doubt this will not be resolved in any brief or swift way and will go on ad infinitum. But it's just part of an ongoing process of change in national identity or confusion over national identity that has really existed since the decline of the British Empire and the decline of Britain's role as a global power. And the process of this occurring is intimately connected with a century of warfare. Now, earlier on this year, I was blogging a great deal on the explaininghistory.wordpress.com blog about Benedict Anderson's classic study of nationalism, Imagined Communities. And the point that he makes, one of the many, many points he makes in there, is nation is an imagined concept. The British state, ability of Britain to project its power militarily, diplomatically or economically, those are fairly tangible things. But a sense of nation, of national identity, involves a person essentially imagining the tribe they belong to. You will never meet all the members of that tribe in your life, and therefore you have to have a kind of a sense of imagined shared values, what it is you think it means to be British, what it thinks you think it means to be French, German, Dutch or anything else. And the way in which Britishness has been imagined throughout the 20th century has changed, but one of the most straightforward ways of imagining a sense of Britishness has been in opposition to or at odds with other nations. A mid-century, perhaps, interpretation of Britishness, and this is something that has lingered on and on. And it's still a kind of a way of articulating Britishness now, is the two world wars and the simple and oversimplified statements that British people have made about successes in those two world wars. The reality, if you read Adam Tooze's The Deluge, is that whilst Britain was on the winning side in the First World War, it loses out immensely from 1916 onwards to the United States in terms of world market shares, the tonnage of shipping, and the shift from London to New York. of the axis of world finance and the beginnings of the transition of Britain from being a global creditor to a global debtor nation. So the First World War, the argument that Britain won the First World War is a tenuous one, and given the two decades of economic crisis that follow, even more tenuous. The idea that Britain won the Second World War is, you know, neatly skewered by many historians that say, well, nearly all of Britain's objectives that she went to fight for, the independence of Poland, the preservation of empire, and Britain's place at the kind of the global top table, are either lost by 1945 or within a generation of 1945. Britain is enormously economically damaged by the Second World War, and her empire is swept away fairly swiftly afterwards. So the idea of Britain as this all-conquering state is unsustainable, and that's why perhaps some of the most cherished British memories and British mythologies of the Second World War revolve around sort of heroic disasters and the ability of Britain to kind of hang on somehow, by which obviously we talk about, you know, the Blitz, Dunkirk and the Battle of Britain. Even when you see cinematic renderings of things like the Bridge on the River Kwai, the British down but not out, these have powerful emotional resonances for cinema-goers throughout the post-war era. One of the complications for Britain is that it is a relatively new multinational state. It's, you know, devised from 1707 onwards, and then between the Act of Union between England and Scotland, becoming the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland in 1800, and then this transitioning after 1922 with the independence of the Irish Free States and the Great Britain and Northern Ireland emerging. So national mythologies have to form the kind of the glue, really, to hold together a kind of a fissile union of separate peoples, of which the English make up the majority and always historically have done. But a Celtic fringe of Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland need to have a narrative that kind of hinges that all together. Now, if you read The Long Shadow by David Reynolds, one of the points that he makes is that war has been the glue that's held the Union together throughout the 20th century, and we would have reached the point we're at now in the 21st century, when Scottish independence is highly likely, increased devolution for Wales is highly likely, and Brexit has presented even the possibility of a unified Ireland once more, leaving a kind of a truncated England to its own devices. This is entirely possible, says David Reynolds, or would have been entirely possible had it not been for two world wars and the Cold War. Powerful external enemies make even the most reluctant of neighbours in the British Isles firm friends. And you have to remember that at in every major campaign fought in the Second World War, there were Scots Guards, Irish regiments, Welsh regiments facing the Japanese, fighting in Italy, fighting in North Africa, in Burma, in Normandy, and all the rest. And a shared sense of ownership of the victory in 1945 can't be underestimated. Some fairly skillful public displays of loyalty and public displays of identification with the sufferings of the British people by the royal family created a deep sense of identification with the royal family in places like Ireland and Scotland and Wales, where now that sense of identification is perhaps in the decline. So that wartime generation, who most of whom have now died out, have viewed the Union flag, the royal family, and a sense of Britishness as being part of their experience. And even though they might primarily identify as Scots, Welsh or Irish, certainly that wartime experience of collective hardship, of collective triumph and collective difficulties is definitely there. And this isn't the first time it's emerged either. If you go back to look at the 18th century, if you look at Linda Colley's epic book, Britons, which I would just recommend to anybody with any interest in questions of national identity, as I would Benedict Anderson or David Reynolds. These are all three epic books. When Linda Colley writes about Britons, she said in the 18th century, one of the key factors that glue together disparate nations within the British Isles to create a more uniform British identity is Protestantism, and the idea that there is a menacing Catholicism on the continent, constantly seeking to undermine God's realm in England and Britain, there have been periods in the past where this external threat has forged unity. And it seems hardly coincidental that Scottish, Irish and Welsh nationalism have been in the ascendancy since the end of the Cold War. The question has presented itself of, well, what is it we need to be frightened of in the outside world that we need to cling together in a union that many nationalists would argue no longer functions? The answer that tends to be presented at the moment is that the fickleness of world markets and currencies and trading blocks and tariffs are the glue that should keep the United Kingdom together, we're better economically together, etc., etc., and it's just not as compelling a story as it's the Germans. War has been a unifying factor as well in terms of social conflict. The decision by the suffragist movement to abandon their activities during the period of the First World War is a notable example, and the embracing of patriotic spirit is sometimes it's suggested that this was a tactical decision by the WSPU and the Pankhursts to demonstrate that, you know, women as loyal citizens of the realm and of the empire could be trusted with the vote after the war. I don't think there's a great deal of evidence to imply that. I think by and large what the picture shows us is that people like the Pankhursts had deep patriotic and conservative with a small c views. They were entirely willing to embrace a national cause, and they equated any threat from Germany as being one that would sweep away any democratic advances they made anyway if the war was lost. I cannot imagine for a moment that had Britain lost or not even entered the First World War, that it would have affected the affairs of the WSPU and the NUWWS in one way or the other. But the popular view that was propagated at the time was that really this is a struggle for civilization. And that whatever Britain is or is not, that the Hun, the German, represents barbarity. This view emerges again in 1939. If you read The Long Shadow by Richard Overy, a book that I'm sure I've banged on about on a number of occasions, he says that...
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
The British Empire, in the eyes of many educated British intellectuals and politicians, and you know, the British bourgeoisie, if you will, represented some notion of civility, of order, of progress, whereas Hitler represented the possibility of a new dark age. So civilization is a theme that runs through British national identity as well. And many of the stories that British people throughout the 20th century have told themselves about empire, of like, well, you know, whatever it is, good or bad, at least we brought civilization to these people. Convenient excuses for imperialism have been a way in which kind of the British story, the British myth, has propagated itself. And the division between empire and dominions is all, whilst at war, is also a very interesting way of observing British national mentalities in remembering war and thus developing identity. The fact that, if we examine D-Day, for example, that the British are mentioned, the Americans are mentioned, and the Canadians rarely are. And the Canadians are lumped in on most maps in school textbooks under the kind of the umbrella of Britain. Despite the fact that they're led by their own generals, they are sent to Europe with the blessing of their own parliament and prime minister. They happen to have a shared queen as a head of state, but you know, one that intervenes on no level in politics. This gives you an idea of how Britain's sense of itself and its importance has emerged in the 20th century, and how the idea of Britishness and the role and agency of the white dominions has kind of merged in British national consciousness. You know, when thinking about how we won the war in North Africa, the role of South Africans, of New Zealanders, of Australians, let alone, I mean, we haven't even spoken about black and Asian soldiers yet. I'll do that in a moment. And also, you know, the Poles, Free French, Free Czechs, and other regiments raised from the kind of the escapees from Europe. These always simply come under the umbrella of the British. What you see fighting in North Africa from 1942 onwards is a kind of a multinational force of everybody from Poles to Indians to Greeks to French to British. And so this rather inconveniently cosmopolitan nature of things tends to get shunted to the side. Now, Britain is, as far as a kind of a national culture who uses warfare and these dramatic moments in history to develop a kind of a coherent narrative, is by no means alone in doing this. And most countries do. It is a way of selecting key aspects of history and retelling them in a particular light. The use of Hindu and Muslim soldiers in Europe and in North Africa in the Second World War and in the Middle East during the First World War is again largely overlooked. If we talk about the Middle East in the First World War, the figure that is most widely known is obviously T.E. Lawrence, Lawrence of Arabia. Whilst Britain's history has been shaped by the actions of its imperial subjects, and Britain's wars have been always heavily reliant on the British Empire's ability to project non-British power around the world, when the Second World War ended, and there was no further prospect of using the Indian Army to keep control of British colonies in Asia, the British Empire in Asia very quickly comes to an end, for example. However, to make a coherent national narrative, these sorts of inconvenient facts have to be rather kind of truncated and got rid of. Another method of developing national identity is that of tragedy, loss, memory and victimhood. And Great Britain, along with perhaps nearly every other major world power, perhaps even every other nation in the world, has an ability to selectively remember the past. The losses of the First World War were sufficient to cast a shadow over the following two decades. Britain, the victorious nation, was also the victim. Britain had involved itself in a futile war, which was seen as an enormous mistake by and large, and the country was populated with 37,000 memorials to the war. Now, the scale of losses comparative to the rest of Europe, which in total suffered some, including the deaths from the Spanish flu afterwards, some 37 million deaths. Britain lost under a million men. But the dominance of narratives such as Journey's End, Brideshead Revisited, and the power of Britain's war poets shaped the view in the 1930s that Britain had experienced almost a mortal blow, that the Britain that emerged after the war was one that was faced with almost inconceivable existential challenges and crises, from extremist politics through to the sense that, if you read Arnold Toynbee, that civilization was coming to an end. The appeal of Winston Churchill as a figure is perhaps explained through this need for national identity, for national unity, for in a society that by the eve of the Second World War was still deeply socially divided, even though the Great Depression had come to an end some 5 years beforehand. And the and it was a society where class resentments and class conflicts don't go away as a result of the war. They still exist and still emerge throughout the wartime years. But Churchill presents himself as a unifying figure, a rallying figure. His oratory and his ability to articulate clearly what the direction of war strategy would be, i.e. we will never surrender, is perhaps what stands him in most stead, his sort of decisions and frequent blunders as a wartime leader, notwithstanding. But again, it is a myth to suggest that the nation came together. You only have to see how working class evacuees, I'm sure I did a podcast on this ages ago, were treated very often by their rural middle class hosts as sort of almost creatures. They're referred to by some of the people that come to charmingly look after them. The view that is presented through Pathé newsreels and through propaganda posters is that it is a nation coming together at one for defined national purpose. Though all the evidence suggests, mass observation evidence suggests, that this didn't really exist. And there hasn't been probably an opportunity to create a similar sense of national unity ever since. Perhaps the rebuilding process after the war, perhaps that brief period of time in the late 50s to the early 60s when the country is riding on the wave of an economic boom, might have presented something similar. But I doubt it. And this is why it's such an attractive... this is why it's such an attractive fantasy. Its genuine elusiveness, its period of time during the war when the nation appeared to be entirely united. After 1945, Britain has involved itself in conflicts all around the world, from Northern Ireland to Aden to Rhodesia to Malaya. Many of these were combinations of post-colonial conflicts and conflicts of decolonisation, along with the ever-present threat of Soviet interference during the Cold War. But none have really had the ability to impact on British national identity in any meaningful way. Most of the involvements of Britain around the world, things like the Suez Crisis or the Malaya Insurgency, were far away and difficult to understand and obscured, and generally they present an attractive narrative of national decline and Britain's involvement in things which seem to, at first glance, to have little real value. And of course, post 9/11 conflicts under Tony Blair have had disastrous effects in terms of unifying people and state and creating a sense of shared values and trust. And the rallying cry of spreading democracy around the world has had precisely nil effect in the minds of most British voters. Now, you probably find, if you to transpose the things we've discussed in this podcast onto any other nation state, you find very similar processes at work. Senses of victimhood, of martyrdom, of special purposes within the world, a sense of unity in the face of a foreign enemy, that kind of thing, all which fuses national identity. But national identities are not static, they are fluid, because generations come and generations go. People with fixed views of things die out, and then their children and grandchildren inherit very different material conditions of the world, one which older stories don't really help to explain and solidify. And as a result, national identities, and indeed nations, become fluid. So there you go. Anyway, I hope you find this interesting today, and you can find me on YouTube if you want to download any extra study stuff, which is I'm doing a bunch of at the moment. And we're transitioning over to a new platform, which is regrettably going to be based on advertising, so that you know, I've got to eat. And that means that I'll be able to put out a lot more content, so the Explaining History podcast should, God willing, within a short space of time, be able to go to bi-weekly, if not slightly more often. So I hope you stick with us, and thanks for your support. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.